In this lecture, we will be looking at immigration and the proliferation of ethnic cuisines in the late 19th and 20th centuries. We will look not only at the people who came to the US and their cooking styles, but also how those cuisines went mainstream and became part of American cooking in general. And you could argue thereafter became part of global cuisine. First, let's look briefly at why immigration happened. Simply enough, it's a demographic explosion. The population of Europe more than doubled in the course of the 19th century, from about 188 million to about 432 million. So Emma Lazarus wasn't kidding when her words appeared on the Statue of Liberty. "Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp," cries she with silent lips. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless tempest tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." Well, there were just too many people. Well, the largest concentration of migration occurred between 1815 and 1924, after which immigration quotas began to be imposed, and about 60 million people left Europe. They went to North and South America, Australia, New Zealand, but the population of North America, including Canada, went roughly from 6 million to 81 million, largely due to immigration. In Europe, naturally, the population explosion led to increased pressure on the land, serious crowding, and usually a generation after a sharp spike in population, the children born in these little baby booms have no other recourse but to leave. And the largest exodus was from precisely those places that were not yet industrialized, where there were no big factories and no teeming cities in which to find work, or colonies in which to find administrative jobs or running plantations. So the places we'll discuss today are not those industrialized nations, but rather the rural and more depressed regions of countries like Eastern Germany, Southern Italy, Ireland, as well as places we haven't discussed at all yet, Poland, Greece, Hungary, Romania, Scandinavia. And the sharpest rise in immigration also came at the very end of the 19th century and early 20th century. And that's partly due to climatic changes and crop failures. There was also a phylloxera epidemic in the wine-growing regions. And of course, now it is physically possible to travel long distances via steamship. So in the first decades of the 20th century alone, over 11 million people left, over five times the amount leaving in the 1850s. And that's even taking account of the Irish potato blight. So although most of the people who emigrated were from poor areas, they were generally not really the poorest of poor. It's usually the small peasant landowner or craftsman whose jobs were being threatened by the big landowners or cheap mass manufactured goods. And of course, you had to be able to afford passage, right? So again, it's not really the urban proletariat or the landless peasants generally. Most of the people who went were also young and unmarried or had very young families. So about 67% of those emigrating to the US were actually under 31, and 90% were under 40. Also, not very well known is that many people went back to Europe after a few years, perhaps as many as one in three, and especially those coming from the Balkans. They came to the US to earn some money, and then they would go home and start a family and maybe buy some land. On the other hand, among some peoples, practically no one returned, and that's the case with the Irish and certainly with the Eastern European Jews. Both of those peoples had no prospect of buying land back in Europe, the former because it was already owned by large-scale farming operations, and the latter because there was, by this time, official persecution back in places like Russia. But let me give you just a few figures about emigration. 34% left Britain and Ireland, and that includes people who went to Canada and Australia, mostly Scots and Irish. Italy is next with 19%, Germany is 11%, Spain 9%, Austria 7%, Poland 5%, Portugal 5%, Russia 4%, Sweden 2%, and Norway 1%. And about half of that whole number ended up in the US. There was also significant migration of Asian peoples. About 3 million Asians left before 1920, mostly from China, Japan, India, and also the Philippines to the US. And that's compared, by the way, to 60 million Europeans. So maybe one Asian for every 20 Europeans. There's a very big difference there. And as is often the case, when one set of families sort of blazes the trail, often a slew of others follow in their wake. Called chain migration. And either, you know, another family member will bring over someone, or they'll go to a place where friends live. And they tend to stick together, therefore, in little enclaves, in their own distinctive neighborhoods, which means that, in general, they don't assimilate, or at least they don't all immediately become like other Americans. They don't sort of melt down into the great melting pot. And I would say, thankfully. The general pattern, though, is that the first generation to emigrate rarely becomes fully assimilated. They tend to speak their old language, they often still wear their old style of dress, and most importantly is they still want to eat the way they did in the old country. Conversely, their children, the second generation who are born here, who go to school here, they don't really want to be thought of as immigrants. They're sort of embarrassed by their foreign parents and their strange ways and their heavy accents. And so the second generation usually does want to assimilate. And then, ironically, it's the third generation who struggles to figure out who they are and where they came from. And suddenly they get interested in the old language and culture and of course, the recipes, too. And I should say, just as an aside, my own experience is a perfect illustration of this. My grandmother, who is a Sephardic Jew from Smyrna, or Izmir in Western Turkey, she still spoke a dialect of Spanish in the house. And oddly, my father learned it because he was actually the oldest in the family, but none of his brothers did. And they were all, to a great extent, assimilated. Even though my father and his brothers grew up eating this Middle Eastern food, the moment they left my grandmother's household, they ate completely American mainstream food. And in fact, to continue with this example, I remember going out with my parents once to this authentic Northern Italian restaurant, and they brought out a little dish of olive oil to the table in which you dip your bread. And my father found that absolutely revolting. He couldn't even bring himself to taste it. And I remember him complaining when I was a kid of how greasy his mother's cooking was, because she basically drizzled olive oil over everything, like all Mediterranean people do, right? And my father, oddly, had no qualms about slathering butter on bread, but the idea of putting oil on it was just horrible to him. And the odd thing, being a third generation person, I love oil. You know, I put it on everything. And I probably eat more like my grandmother than my father did. So what the second generation tries to forget, the third tries desperately to remember. The other interesting thing about the influx of peoples is that although their own tastes may have changed from generation to generation, and they may or may not have become assimilated, I think it was easier for some groups than others. Most of the cuisines of these peoples did survive. And sometimes, you know, they would evolve making use of ingredients that were available in the US, or they would use new cooking implements, or they may have toned down the flavors after a few generations. And I think this is really a natural evolution that occurs with all cuisines, and it shouldn't really be looked on as a kind of bastardization. Even more fascinating is that most of these cuisines have, to some degree, been adopted by Americans on the whole. So this is not only a story about food among immigrants, or so-called ethnic food in the US, but some ethnic dishes go completely mainstream, and others are at least known by most Americans, or at least recognized as, say, coming from a very specific place. And many ethnic dishes, of course, get toned down, or they get adapted to broader American tastes, especially served in restaurants, but they still survive in some form. And for some of these cuisines, the fact that immigrants open up affordable restaurants meant that other Americans kind of learn about their food. And that's certainly the case with Chinese food, with Greek, Italian, with Jewish delicatessens, certainly. Now, regarding culinary evolution, I think Mexican food is probably the one that has changed most drastically over the years. For example, the hard-shell taco that took off in the U.S. after World War II. It's not really the same thing that it is in Mexico, which is almost always, you know, a soft corn tortilla. And in that sense, the U.S. style of taco is not, strictly speaking, authentic. But think for a moment, what does authentic mean anyway? I think we're a little too obsessed with authenticity because, you know, people have finally realized that really ethnic foods have changed over time. Let me give you an example of this. You probably know this already. In Naples, you know, they don't put pepperoni and 12 other toppings on a pizza. In Ireland, the Irish don't live on corned beef and cabbage. Fortune cookies were, in fact, not invented. Well, they're sort of invented in America, but they're descended from a Japanese cookie. In fact, there's a recent book by Jennifer Eight Lee that describes this process. But these kind of little revelations, they can be upsetting, you know, and people feel they have to sort of search out the one authentic, original way a dish should be prepared. But cooking, of course, always changes over time and from place to place. And as you know from this course, when dishes travel, they change subtly. They get reinvented. They become something new. And that's a good thing, right? Jamaican food wouldn't be nearly as interesting without the Spanish and the African and the English and the Indian influences. So change and development is a good thing. The metaphor I like to use in this case is cooking is like biology. You want things to evolve. And since you need to mix up the genes to see if new combinations arise, otherwise the organism or the cuisine stagnates. It stops evolving. So that kind of evolution is actually a very good thing. Now, not that I'm going to praise the lowest common denominator, but we shouldn't look down on American versions of, say, Mexican food just because they're different from what we imagine the authentic is like. And if there ever could be one truly authentic way of making anything, I don't know. You know, authentic in relation to what? You know, a dish, the way it was prepared in a particular place at some random time in some arbitrary restaurant. I mean, it's actually the obsession with maintaining traditions, ironically enough, has created some interesting fossils among immigrant populations. That is, they may prepare a dish or eat a certain food with a meticulous care that it not be changed, while back in the mother country, the dish has evolved or sometimes disappears entirely. I think it's ironic that Nordic people in the U.S. eat more lutefisk than they do back in Scandinavia. Lutefisk is a fish cured in lye, so it has this very odd gelatinous texture, and it smells a little like ammonia. But it's a way to preserve fish. It's not necessary anymore. But the odd thing is, it's very hard to find outside the Midwest. Most immigrant cuisines also have, they have some of these culinary fossils. Another example is the bialy. It's a cousin of the bagel. It just has a little depression in the center, and it's filled with chopped onions, but it's baked rather than being boiled. Well, it's completely disappeared in its homeland of Bialystok in Poland, but it still exists here, here and there in the U.S. But cuisines must change too, or they become museum relics. And without the original ingredients, the same cooking utensils, the fuel source, or even the same social context, it's impossible and futile to even try to make authentic dishes. You know, on the other hand, I will admit that there are clear abominations. I mean, spaghetti in a can is just a bad idea, period. So, another truly fascinating phenomenon is when an item becomes mainstream and then is re-exported back to the home country in a new form. You can find a kind of U.S. pizza by the slice now in Italy, and it's really not for tourists. But sometimes, of course, it's a mass-manufactured or a canned version that's exported, sometimes back home, but more often elsewhere. For example, you might be surprised to find that Scandinavians love tacos, and they buy these pre-made shells and seasonings in a kit. It's amazing. But let's get into the details of this story. Much of this you're going to know already, which is, of course, testimony to the extent of how our eating habits have been shaped by immigrants. Notice also that in all these cuisines, it's the strong and often extended family unit that ensures recipes get passed down. It may be that sole factor that accounts for passing down cooking skills and traditional recipes, by and large, are kept among immigrant groups. Now, keep in mind, that the many ways that eating traditional foods is an expression of identity, or even a kind of performance of identity, if you will, it kind of reminds you, as well as others, of who you are. It serves to bind the community together with a shared experience, and the most important of these, of course, is food. So let's start with Italy. There's probably no single cuisine that has become more thoroughly adopted by Americans than Italian. And many of the basic ingredients, of course, grown or raised in Italy, they're also grown here and were in fact introduced by Italian farmers. And you know, it's funny, that's why we use the Italian names for these vegetables. Think of broccoli or zucchini, which in Europe they call marrows. It's an American plant though, right? Or radicchio or arugula. And other foods that were not originally familiar to Americans were introduced. I mean, things like olive oil, even wine by and large. And it was originally Italians in California that first cultivated wine grapes on a large scale. And a whole slew of other vegetables entered into the American diet after Italians settled here. Things like artichokes and eggplant and tomatoes and peppers and garlic. And they're specifically associated with Italians because Northern Europeans don't really eat those things, right? And it's ironic, of course, that tomatoes had to be reintroduced to the Americas by Italians. But why do you think it's these fruits and vegetables specifically? Think about where most of the immigrants came from. It's southern Italy, which has a far more heavily vegetable-based diet than in the more affluent north. And if you think of all the most typical Italian foods we eat, spaghetti or macaroni made from durum semolina and dried with tomato sauce, I mean, that's a southern Italian combination. As is pizza in Naples. Of course, it's just a thin, plain circle of dough, plate-sized, sometimes just tomato sauce, or maybe the classic margherita, which has tomato, mozzarella di bufala, and a few basil leaves cooked in a wood-burning oven. They also drizzle oil on it. So why does pizza change when it gets here in the US? Well, it's cooked in a commercial pizza oven, right? And with more affluence, more people want to eat more ingredients. They want meat on it. They want it larger. And why cut it in slices? I think it's because we are a faster paced society. We don't want to be bothered with a plate and cutlery. We want to pick it up and put it in our mouth, and even if it means burning the roof of your mouth, right? And we want to be able to walk away with it or take it home or have it delivered in a big box. And the pizzeria selling by the slice is really an American invention, but they have it in Italy now too, because Italians, of course, they're more like us now. And if we look at the roots of this cuisine in southern Italy, it's based mostly on a few simple ingredients. It was traditionally very frugal, like other Mediterranean cuisines, as a result of poverty, of course. But it was also inventive. I mean, think of the wide variety of dishes you can make with just these few staples. Wheat, cheese, vegetables, fish on Friday, a small amount of meat, and we're talking like cured products like sausages and salami. You just eat those in a small amount. But once it gets to the US, where food is cheap and abundant, you get a lot more meat. Spaghetti is served with meatballs, which is fairly unthinkable in Italy. It's a great combination nonetheless, but you get lavish casseroles like lasagna or baked ziti that are brimming with meat and cheese. Foods are fried more often, especially fish. And in general, the cuisine evolves in ways that make it quite different from the original. And sometimes, though the ingredients may be exactly the same, the meaning changes completely. Think of bacalà. That's a dried codfish eaten in Lent because it lasts forever, it's very cheap. But in the US, it's very expensive now, and it's eaten mostly for nostalgic reasons or to maintain tradition. And the fact that dishes change is, of course, the origin of the very idea of authenticity. People going back to Italy as tourists maybe, and they discover that the food is different than what they supposed. And then they reintroduce these authentic versions. They serve them in restaurants, or they sell products that are marketed as being original. And someone figures out that in Italy, they eat gelato, very different from American ice cream. It's actually based on milk rather than more cream and air. And, you know, the irony is that it was mostly Italians who actually popularized ice cream in mainstream US in the first place. But in any case, Italian food is very interesting because it only catches on outside these immigrant groups when it's marketed widely. Tomato sauce in a can, for example, is only made in the US on a large scale once we get into a war with Italy, and then the supply of imported sauce dries up, And new U.S. manufacturers think, well, there's no reason not to sell this to all Americans. And they do it very, very successfully. It's the same story with dry pasta, with Parmesan cheese, with macaroni and cheese. I mean, we don't even think of that as being Italian anymore, do we? The fact that these foods become American is also ironic considering that nutritionists did their best to change the eating habits of Italian immigrants. They thought their cooking was too spicy, reeks too much of garlic, not well balanced because there were so many vegetables, and especially because these people didn't eat enough meat or drink milk. Now, thankfully, they failed. In a complete reversal of fate, everyone started eating Italian food. And that's the result not only of the restaurants, but especially of mass-manufactured Italian-American food. Another example of an ethnic cuisine that has gone mainstream is Jewish, and I'm talking food from Eastern Europe. And the majority of these people were Ashkenazic Jews coming from Poland and Russia, but also Hungary, Romania, parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and they tended not to leave from more affluent regions like Germany or Vienna or Prague. All of these Jews also spoke Yiddish, regardless of where they came from. So in the 1880s, when there were official pogroms in Russia, they started leaving by the thousands. And they continued to arrive up until 1924, when the official quotas on immigration were installed. But by that time, about 2.3 million had arrived. And the vast majority of them settled in cities on the East Coast, especially New York's Lower East Side, Brooklyn. And they tended to be upwardly mobile. I mean, being a culture that places a great deal of emphasis on education. But like the Italians, the Jews are very serious about their food, and they use it as a mark of identity. I mean, even if they don't keep kosher, you know, the Jews tend to eat many of the same things on holidays, which are, on the holidays, if you remember, they're more about food than anything else, especially Passover. And the cuisine of Eastern European Jews, I should mention, is not really that different from what their non-Jewish neighbors back in Europe were eating. It was just adapted. So, for example, they couldn't obviously eat pork, but they could eat beef, and that was made into a whole slew of cured products, things like corned beef, pastrami, pickled tongues. I mean, all those things that we would associate today with a kosher deli, as well as dill pickles and knishes. Another thing all their neighbors ate was dumplings, but uniquely, Jews made them out of matzo meal. So that's a matzo ball or a knedlach, and of course you eat it in a chicken soup. There's another fascinating dish called Lakshin Kugel, and it's pretty typical Eastern European dish, but introduced to the U.S. by the Jewish communities. And essentially, imagine this dish of light noodles mixed with eggs, baked in a casserole. It's sweet. It sometimes includes raisins. But the fascinating thing is the word comes from the ancient Persian laksha, and that's the word for noodle, and it's also the same word you find in Indonesia, laksa. It's the same exact word. So although there are many Jewish dishes that never went mainstream, I think the most fascinating one that did is the bagel. And the first thing to understand about a bagel, first, is that it is boiled and then baked. So it has a very crunchy exterior and a very soft inside. It's not round bread with a hole. And it shouldn't need to be toasted. And the traditional way to eat them, of course, is with cream cheese, perhaps lox. And that's something, of course, eaten all across the Baltic. It's related to Scandinavian gravlax. It's basically just salmon cured with salt and then pressed, but it's still raw. Some people put a slice of onion on it. Okay. But how did the bagel change in the U.S.? You know, apart from poor imitations, it's a matter of the range of flavors. Americans are apparently people who love variety and choice, because originally bagels were plain. You know, maybe there'd be salt on it, maybe egg, but now think of the variety they come in. There's cinnamon, raisin, chocolate, whole wheat, pumpkin I've seen. I mean, there's a whole slew of bizarre flavors. But think about the many dishes inherited from immigrant groups. There's German frankfurters and bratwurst and pretzels and sauerkraut. There's Greek hummus and spanakopita and baklava, Scandinavian food that flourishes in the Midwest, Polish kielbasa and pierogies. But let's divert from European immigration to discuss the other immigrant cuisines, specifically those which are good examples of how foods become mainstream, again through marketing and through restaurants. The story of Mexican immigration is, of course, unique, partly because many of the people didn't immigrate. The U.S. swallowed a huge chunk of what was once part of Mexico. I'm talking about the entire Southwest, California, and Texas. And there was, of course, immigration later also, partly in the form of migrant labor, but also a lot of people who came just looking for jobs, and not always permanently, since they often went back given the proximity. As anyone who has been to Mexico will tell you, the cuisine is extremely varied and very different from what we think of here as Mexican food, which is largely cuisine of the border regions or perhaps Tex-Mex. But the issue of authenticity aside, the remarkable thing about this cuisine is, despite the status of Mexicans themselves, the cuisine gained a huge following. And think about the fact that the number one sauce in the U.S. today is jarred salsa. It displaced ketchup a few years ago. And think about the prevalence of tortilla chips and nachos and tacos and burritos and fajitas. You know what all those things are. These all are evolved forms of relatives that existed and still exist back in Mexico. And they all become well known among the general populace through mass manufactured products, things like initially Doritos or Mexican restaurants that serve what American diners expect. And these, you know, there's a wide range of them. They're from Taco Bell chains or things like El Torito or Chi-Chi's all the way to Chipotle, and including, you know, family-owned Mexican restaurants and even very high-end Mexican restaurants like the one Rick Bayless runs. But there is, for the most part, a standard repertoire of dishes that are uniquely, let's say, Mexican-American. But the real question is why they became popular. Even though the range of flavors is significantly toned down, Mexican cuisine is exciting precisely because it's spicy and well-seasoned and offers a range of flavors and textures that are completely outside of what most people think of as standard American fare. But at the same time, it is familiar. It's recognizable. You know what you will get when some kind of tortilla is wrapped in something familiar, when there's Spanish rice on the side, refried beans, maybe guacamole, and you get to drink something like a margarita or something else based on tequila. And that is, I think its popularity has to do with this codification. It's being limited to a repertoire of standard dishes. And some might say, of course, this does disservice to the real thing, in which you find a whole slew of, of things few Americans would eat unless consciously hunting down something authentic. You know, tamales, menudo, which is a soup made with stomach tripe, a cabrito goat, or maybe a salad made of nopalitos, which is a prickly pear cactus. But I think it is, in fact, the simplification that's been a key to the spread of Mexican cuisine. You could say much the same about Chinese cuisine, which is by and large Cantonese cooking that evolved from 19th century mishmash of whatever immigrants could find, and given few of the same vegetables or cooking implements or much of anything that would have been familiar back in China. Thus we have chop suey, a Chinese-American invention, fried rice, shao mein or lo mein, egg rolls, wonton soup, sweet and sour pork, General Tso's chicken, beef with broccoli. You know, notice they're almost all stir-fried meat and vegetables and a rice as a side. And again, I think this is a fairly limited repertoire. There's a standard set of flavorings, so you know soy, ginger, garlic, sesame oil, they're going to be in there. But nothing that would kind of surprise or alarm diners. And that's exactly why it goes mainstream, because it becomes codified and predictable, and Chinese restaurants, of course, proliferate everywhere, especially with takeout. And then eventually what happens is you get, you know, La Choy or Chongqing, you get Chinese food in a can, or frozen Chinese food, or instant convenient kinds of Chinese food. And it seems like the narrowing of the menu, using familiar ingredients and then marketing, explain how Americans become such avid consumers of these ethnic cuisines. The continued interest is evidently due to the continual discovery of more and more authentic forms of these cuisines, local variants, and even more exotic dishes to entice intrepid diners. And as we have seen throughout the course, the history of food is a constant interchange of ingredients, techniques, and recipes, And I think the period of mass migration is perhaps the most significant exchange influencing the way we eat that has ever occurred. Yet another set of influences was afoot in the early 20th century, which we will cover in the next lecture, and in particular, the influence of mechanized warfare, feeding armies, and of course, managing wartime rations on the home front.